This is Scott Becker, and I'm thrilled today to be joined by Dr. Paul Offit. Paul is with one of the highest rated children's hospitals in the country, the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He's going to talk about what he sees with the coronavirus, a little bit about leadership and more. Dr. Offit, can you take a moment and introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Paul Offit. I am a professor of pediatrics in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and a professor of pediatrics also at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine.
Well, thank you. Your specialty in infectious disease, what is your sense? Have we seen anything like this in our lifetime? How do you compare this to the swine flu, the 57 flu? Anything else that you've seen or know about professionally? How do you look at this outbreak compared to some of these other things?
Well, so take the 2009-2010 swine flu pandemic. That was a pandemic for which we had a vaccine in advance, so that did lessen it to some extent. But that pandemic, which was considered a relatively mild pandemic, caused 203,000 deaths in the world and about 12,000 deaths in the United States. I'd be surprised if we came close to that number of deaths in the United States. I mean, we're at roughly 600 deaths, you know, about a month or so into the community spread with this. I think this will be ameliorated likely by as we move from sort of spring to summer. So there is a time limit on this. I don't see us getting to 12,500 deaths. I'd be surprised if we got to 5,000 deaths. And although all of it's awful, I don't think it really is going to touch what we see for even mild flu pandemics.
Well, let me ask you about that, because that's a very comforting view. If you look at a place like Italy, and I'm assuming that Italy, if it's already at 7,000-8,000 deaths, is going to get to 25,000 deaths. We're four times the size of Italy. Why wouldn't someone do the math and say if they're going to get to 25,000-30,000 deaths? I mean, it seems like at least we're on that curve, and I know there's all kinds of complications in counting. Why don't we see ourselves getting to 80,000-100,000 deaths? And 80,000-100,000 deaths, and again, in a normal flu year, we might have 30,000-60,000 deaths. So it's not a crazy, crazy number. It's obviously a horrible thing, but why aren't we headed towards those kinds of numbers?
Or you could say it the other way. You could say that China, which is a population of 1.4 billion people, has reported 3,000 deaths, and they are at least three times bigger than us, so therefore we'll only have 1,000 deaths. I think, you know, we'll see how it plays out. Italy, I'm not sure, is a great example. First of all, they do have an older population. 25% of their population is over 65 as compared to 16% for us. Two, it's really a northern Italy phenomenon, more so sort of the area around Milan, which is a rural area for which there's not a lot of great intensive care, health care available in that area. So I'm not sure they're relevant to us. They certainly are an outlier. I mean, the fact that they have 7,000 deaths to China's 3,000 with a population that's dramatically smaller is interesting, but I do think there may be things unique to Italy that have nothing to do with us.
Thank you. So let me ask you a question then. If you look at the number of deaths here, and again, 100 deaths today, but you know, we probably have 9,000 deaths a day for all kinds of other causes, just to give it context, then you get to the next question, and I'll ask the economic questions last. The next question is, how do we manage this so we do have death numbers that are closer to the 12,000 or less numbers that we had in the swine flu, or whatever number would be a number that you'd say, that's not that out of line for any strange epidemic we have or a bad flu season. How do we manage it nationally to keep those numbers within they're horrible for anybody whose family who dies, of course, anybody who's a family member, but how do we keep those numbers at a rational number in total?
Well, let me put this in other perspective. Every year, this country has an epidemic of influenza. This year is actually fairly typical. 2 years ago was a bad year, 2017, 2018. This year is an average year. We have roughly 21 to 30 million cases of influenza. We have about 300,000 to 500,000 hospitalizations from influenza. And we have between 25,000 and 60,000 deaths from influenza this year, epidemic influenza. What's going on with COVID-19 does not approach that. Now, it's all bad. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I think we need to do what we're doing right now because we're in this kind of log phase, this exponential phase of growth of cases and deaths in our country. But I'm optimistic we're going to get on top of this. I mean, what you're seeing now is you're seeing what we did sort of 2 or 3 weeks ago, which wasn't enough. I think now people are scared and they are staying home and they are whatever you want to call it, either sheltering in place or locking down. But I think what with that, I think that you will start to see that we come off the curve somewhere in the next 2 to 3 weeks. That's my prediction. We'll see, because I do think there's another side to this. I mean, there's the pandemic that's caused by the virus and the suffering and the hospitalization caused by the virus. But by basically doing what we're doing, which is shutting down the American workforce, I mean, the estimates are that we will have 2.5 million lost jobs this coming week. If we have a 20% loss in terms of jobs, that's estimated to be about 35 million people that lose their jobs. With joblessness comes homelessness and all the things associated with homelessness: crime, domestic abuse, child abuse, suicide, depression, et cetera. So I think there is that other side of this that needs to be considered. So all I'm saying is that I think we need to lock down, as just like we're doing now. But once we start to come off that curve, I think there needs to be rules in place for how we're going to now start to crawl out of our homes and go to school and go to work.
Well, and it's really important, because you say the flip side of this is with extreme poverty and great poverty, you could have death and all kinds of other health problems that are worse than this. And so it's this fine and challenging balancing act. Fascinating. How do you see this ending? Does this end in treatment for it, or is it more likely compared to other flus that it ends with vaccines, and vaccines are helpful for a percentage of people? How does that work out?
Well, so there are two antivirals that I think are promising: remdesivir, and then another one called flavipiravir, for which there are Japanese data that look promising. We'll see. I think they need to be tested, and we'll see. I think the sort of hydroxychloroquine, azithromycin story, I'd be surprised if that were of value, but it's, again, testable, so we'll see. In terms of vaccines, there's every reason to believe a vaccine could work. I mean, human coronavirus has been known about since the 1960s, so there are four human strains of human coronavirus that circulate, and it does look like infection with one does protect you against that same type, so that's a good sign. That bodes well for a vaccine. And you know about the virus, and you know the protein on the virus that you're going against, that you care about, which is the surface protein of the virus. So there's currently an mRNA vaccine, messenger RNA vaccine. It's being tested in Washington State. I think that there's every reason to believe that it could work and that it would be safe. But again, you really do need a solid 18 months to 2 years or longer to make sure that it's safe and it's effective. And by that time, this may be gone much as the way SARS and MERS were gone, which were two other novel coronaviruses.
And so ultimately, for vaccines to really be of help, between testing them and manufacturing them, you really are looking at 12 to 18 months.
Well, that is ridiculously fast. I mean, maybe I'm a bad sport. I was fortunate enough to work with a team at Children's Hospital Philadelphia that created the strains that became the vaccine Rotatec, the rotavirus vaccine, and that took us 26 years. So that you could make a vaccine that quickly, you just want to make sure you don't cut corners. And you also want to make sure, because there's such fear in the community right now, people are willing to perhaps take treatments which may not be advisable, or, you know, rush a vaccine in production, which is never a good idea. So let's make sure that we're putting ourselves in the safest position possible.
And so you're an infectious disease specialist. You know, this seems, as I talk to you, you're able to put this in context of other flu outbreaks, pandemics, other kinds of outbreaks. And from a U.S. perspective, it's scarier than SARS and MERS, only because we saw so little of it here. At one point, we saw the West Nile thing here, and that was a little scary because it was here. How do you sort of look at this? Are we overreacting, rightly reacting? How do you sort of view the country's posture to this? Because obviously in my lifetime, and I'm probably not that different in age than you are, we've never had anything like this in terms of shutting down parts of the country. Is that just partly fear of the unknown? Is it us watching what's going on in Europe and saying, oh my God, we have to get ahead of this because look at how bad that is? What's some of your perspective on this?
I think it's fear of the unknown. We're still learning about this virus. And, you know, when you see something like what goes on in Italy, you certainly don't want to have that happen here. I mean, you know, when you have upwards of 7,000 plus deaths in a population that's, you know, 60 million people. I mean, it's like a sixth of our population. You want to make sure that you don't go where they go. And so therefore you act very very cautiously, very conservatively, which is what we're doing right now. Stay home until we get a handle on this. The good news about this, if there's any good news at all, is that we do know the target group. I mean, the target group generally are people over 70 who have comorbidities like hypertension and type 2 diabetes and obesity. That's really who dies. Unlike, say, the 2009 swine flu. 2009 swine flu, of the 12,000 deaths in the United States, only 20% were those greater than 65. That virus killed healthy young people. That's really not this virus. And that is very reassuring, actually, in terms of herd immunity. So, for example, if kids get infected or young adults get infected, the odds are they're just going to be immune, which then creates more population immunity, which makes it harder for the virus to spread without, you know, sort of sacrificing them because they're so unlikely to really be very sick by this virus.
Gotcha. And in terms of spring, summer respiratory illnesses, we've already passed, at least in where I live, which is Chicago, the peak of the flu season a few weeks ago. It's been a tough flu season in the United States. What's your sense of how much relief we get just naturally as the flu season dies down? Is that a common myth? You're an infectious disease guy. What's your take on that?
Right. So if this acts like human coronaviruses, like the viruses we see every winter in our hospital, about 15-20% of the respiratory infections that come into our hospital are coronaviruses. It's just the human coronaviruses, not these novel coronaviruses. So the question is this virus, which is a novel virus, which is a bat coronavirus for the most part, it's not a human virus. It hasn't been really well adapted to growth in the human population. Will this be like those viruses? Will it be a winter-spring virus? I think there's evidence that it might be. Greece, for example, is not suffering this problem, even though neighbors to the north are. When the temperatures are higher and humidity is higher, what that tends to do is it takes the small droplets that come out of your mouth when you sneeze or cough, and those droplets then accrete water and therefore fall much more quickly, and therefore you're less contagious. That's the reason that people give for why it is you don't see it in when it gets hotter and more humid. And so we'll see what happens as we move into May and June. But my suspicion is that this will be affected by climate. We'll see.
In terms of, there's all these wild theories out there that this came from a snake, a bat, to a pangolin, which is some kind of anteater, to it came out of a Chinese bioweapons, laboratory, stuff like that. I mean, is there any sort of is an infectious disease leader, specialist, brilliant leader at one of the top-rated hospitals in the world, can you count some of these crazy theories out, or are they all worth thinking about and in inspecting?
Well, it's a bat virus. I mean, it's been sequenced. We have the virus. It's 96% bat coronavirus. It appears that there might have been an intermediate host like a civet or a pangolin, which I'd never even heard of until the people started talking about that, and I had to look it up to see what they were. They're basically small mammals. So that may have been true. It's certainly not something that was weaponized, in Wuhan by people who mean to do us harm. This happens periodically. It happened with SARS. It happened with MERS. Now it's happened here. Those viruses were when you got infected with those viruses, SARS and MERS, you were much sicker. So it was easier to sort of put a moat around the people that were sick and stop spread. This virus is spread more easily because there's a lot of asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic infection, which makes it harder to stop the spread.
Got it. Any advice for our governors, our president, and so forth? It seems like that whichever side you're on this, you've got crazy criticism for the other side. Any thoughts from you on this? Is this just a very difficult job of balancing safety with the economy, or is there thoughts you have on this?
Well, what you need is a federal policy. I mean, you need clear guidelines as to what we're looking at. We've got behind the eight ball in many respects here, not the least of which was testing. So we don't really have a sense of how common this is. I think once we start to do seroepidemiological studies, which is to say to see whether people develop an antibody response to this virus, I think you're going to find there's a huge base to this iceberg that we've been dealing with, and that'll help actually. But at the very least, what are we looking at? What are we looking at in terms of hospitals to say that we now feel comfortable that they're not going to be overwhelmed? What are we looking at in terms of transmission and cases and less cases than deaths and severe cases to say that now we're starting to get on top of the curve? What are those? What are the rules? And that's where you need a clear federal policy, because right now each of the governors of the states are sort of acting independently. And I feel like we're kind of lurching in the dark because we don't really know what the rules are here. And so people are panicking because there's a sense that we don't know what we're doing.
Well, and it's sort of that concept that a vacuum is being filled because there's not that clarity.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Got it. So thus you have like, and you have very different positions taken by very different governors on how much they want to shut down versus shutting down their economy to try and balance this with looking at what's going to look like on the other side of this with the debt in those states and so forth, but also trying to avoid the flooding of the hospitals. I mean, this Italy example is, and there might be very good reasons to differentiate it, but it's an object lesson of what people want to avoid. And so you have, you know, I mean, perhaps you do or don't have a very strong reaction in places because people are very scared of that.
And remember, Japan's gotten on top of it. Singapore got on top of this without ever closing schools. South Korea's gotten on top of this. So it is possible to get on top of this. And I think we finally are getting it. I think the administration certainly denied the seriousness for this for a while. I mean, frankly, it wasn't until the stock market started to crash that the administration really started to pay attention to this. But I think now, you know, with Dr. Fauci, I think, leading the way, he has told us, you know, stay home for now till we get on top of this. And I think it's great advice. And when we start, all I'm asking is that when we start to get on top of that, how do we know that? What are the markers for that? And how can we start to crawl out of our homes and go to school and go to work?
Right. Because for all we know, it's such a common and so contagious that, as you said, the tip of the iceberg, so many people have this, we just don't know really.
Exactly.
And in some ways, if so many people have this and we start to find that the real mortality rates are down at 0.03, 0.04, it's horrible. But it's much closer to a bad flu than it is something much worse.
You know, it's interesting. When the 2009-2010 swine flu hit the United States, when there was, again, 12,000 deaths, the original mortality estimates were 4%. When people did seroepidemiologicals, I see really how many people actually were infected, the mortality rate was less than 0.01%.
Because they found so many people were infected.
That's right, that we just didn't know about.
Right. I mean, it seems like in some ways we're moving in that direction here, and certainly in South Korea and Singapore, they're starting to show mortality rates that are, you know, bad, but much closer to a bad flu outbreak than a horrible, horrible, you know, crazy virus that's going to kill 3% of us. But that is part of the testing issue that you're talking about.
Yeah, it really, I think, you know, because we want people to stay home, I think that this has been sold as in a scary way that's really unlikely. I mean, take a step back. We have 600 people so far who've died, and maybe we'll have a few thousand people who die, and that's bad. But I'm just saying that when you put it in context of just epidemic flu, it's really logarithmically less. So, but I think what scares people is it's from China. We don't, it has a fancy name, COVID-19. You know, and there's so much hype on television media. It's like 24 hours a day, you know, coronavirus. You wouldn't even know that we're coming up on a presidential election.
Now, your favorite name for the virus. Now, I know it's you can't call it the Wuhan or China virus because it's become so politicized. But COVID-19 versus a novel coronavirus, do you have a preference in what you refer to it as?
Well, I like novel coronavirus. It's just because it's a little gentler. COVID-19 sounds awful. It sounds like something that came out of, you know, out of some science fiction movie.
It really does. Well, Dr. Offit, I can't tell you how much we appreciate you joining us today. We'll try and get this logged in and out tomorrow or so. Just a pleasure visiting with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you very much.